From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Coming up on the show today, a photographer comes to Milwaukee to document the stories of black Milwaukeeans who migrated here decades ago.
I was very blunt in asking, when you got to Milwaukee, you know, did you come to escape the racism of the South? And their answer, by and large, was no. I mean, I came for jobs, and what I found here was a place that was equally racist, but it was different. We were, in theory, allowed to go to different neighborhoods, but not really.
Then actress Erica Slezak won 6 Emmys for her role in the soap opera One Life to Live, but she started her professional career 50 years ago right here in Milwaukee.
I was in such rapture about just having a job and being there that I never even bothered to think where I was or what I was going to do or anything like that. I just knew the way from my little apartment to the theater.
And we'll have the latest episode of our storytelling series, Ex-Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. During the mid-1900s, the Great Migration brought millions of African Americans from rural southern towns to cities like Chicago, Detroit, and, of course, Milwaukee. To this day, many older black Milwaukeeans have roots in the South. Many moved here as teens and young adults, looking for work in an industrial city that, at the time, overflowed with jobs.
Chris Arnotti is a writer and photographer whose photo essay entitled Great Migrants appears in this month's Milwaukee magazine. The photo essay features older Milwaukeeans who came here during the Great Migration. Arnotti spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and explained why he had decided to come to Milwaukee to write this piece.
I've been doing a 4-year project on poverty, addiction, and in lower class America. And one of the aspects of my project is racism and how it plays out. And, you know, by many statistical measures, Milwaukee has one of the most segregated, is one of the most segregated towns in the United States. And so I chose the traditional African American neighborhood to profile, to look at issues along about segregation and racism and poverty.
It seems like you focused specifically on Sherman Park. Did you go to any other neighborhoods?
In general, when I first got to Milwaukee, the first time I got to Milwaukee was in September. I believe it's North Avenue. I parked my car at the McDonald's on North Avenue, and I just walked, I don't know, 40 blocks, 50 blocks, kind of west, just to get a lay of the land. I don't, when I come into a town, I really don't do tons of research. I let my kind of instincts drive me. I usually started in McDonald's, and so I parked my car at McDonald's on North, I believe it was on North Avenue, yeah, and I walked west.
Why do you start at McDonald's?
For what I do, I find McDonald's to be, basically, I call them, you know, ad hoc community centers, and that particular McDonald's has a very active group of, sometimes they label themselves Romeo Clubs, retired old men eating out, and, you know, I got to know some of the older men there. And they taught me a little bit about the neighborhood and their past. So it was kind of my introduction to, you know, how the neighborhood operates.
It's funny that you say that because you profile, of course, people at a McDonald's. And I thought to myself, oh, I'm from a small town and the McDonald's is very much that way. It's a lot of older folks who go there for coffee often. And they are these kind of clubs almost. Now, you had a chance to speak to a number of people. Was that on your first day here?
I was in Milwaukee on 2 separate occasions. The first time was in September when I was writing for The Guardian. And that story was more about some of the frustrations of the neighborhood that I came to see during that week. And I had contacted Milwaukee Magazine at the end of that week and said, you know, there's this other story here, which is really fascinating, is almost every older African-American I speak to is from Mississippi or Louisiana or Alabama. And I think that would be a really interesting thing to explore. So I came back the second time last month to do that in January. And so some of the people who I met that first day ended up me going back and meeting them again, you know, that first day in September. I came back to meet again in January and dig more into their story.
So whenever I see pieces like this, you know, I'm always curious to know about how these moments happen. You know, how did you meet all of the people you spoke with?
For the piece for the Milwaukee, for the second piece that's coming out in the Milwaukee magazine, I just walked into McDonald's and, you know, initially said, hey, you know, you must be the old man club. And they're like, yeah, we are. How do you know? And I'm like, well, but then it ended up being me just driving, because it was in January at that point, so it was cold, driving around. And I was passing, you know, this bar, and that it must have been 9 o'clock in the morning on, I believe it was a Monday morning, and it was cold, and it was in the same neighborhood, but it wasn't on North. And there was a bar, and there was a big, large truck in front of it that had a big Packer paraphernalia all over the truck. And I'm like, I got this in the case. I just felt that the bar was open, even though it was 9 in the morning. So I just walked in, and it was a Casper's Lounge, and it ended up being not only open, but it opened at 6:30 in the morning. And there were 5 or 6 people in there, including the gentleman who ran it. And I just introduced myself and ended up staying off and on in that bar for the next 3 days and meeting a lot of the regulars as well as the owner, and really, you know, getting a kind of a sense of the neighborhood through that one bar.
Of course, that is a quintessentially Milwaukee thing, a bar that is open in the morning.
Yeah, see, I didn't know that as an outsider. So, but I grew to, you know, and then so I, you know, after that first day when I had gone to this bar, I went again that evening. And I got there not at 8, and they were just about to close, and that would kind of confuse me that a bar would close at 10. But, you know, I guess they opened at 6. And so it was kind of that vibrancy, that kind of activity that I really kind of drew me in the second time, and kind of what I wrote about for the Milwaukee Magazine, profiling both the men and women at the McDonald's, but also at the bar, and then at a senior citizen center as well, over on Martin Luther King Drive.
As a Wisconsinite, so much of what I see in your photographs and so much of what you talk about or your subjects talk about seems very Wisconsin, but you describe specifically the Black community in Milwaukee as being very Southern in a Northern city. What makes it so Southern?
If you talk to African-American Milwaukeean, is that the term you use?
Milwaukeean,
over the age of 60, there's a good chance that they were born in Mississippi or Louisiana or Alabama and came here when they were 15, 14, 16, 20. As somebody who spent a lot of time in the African-American portions of the South, I can tell you that the neighborhoods in Milwaukee feel very much like just a cold Mississippi, you know, part of the Delta. It feels very... You know, you have the barbecues out on people's porches. You have the bars. I believe there's another bar called Catfish Lounge as well. You know, it feels very much like a Southern city.
What is it like sharing your day with a group of people who you've just met?
It's kind of what I do for a living, so I guess it feels natural at this point to me. But I generally find if, you know, in 6 or 7 years of doing this, I've never had anybody really be... rude to me. They're always very welcoming, especially, you know, if you handle yourself appropriately. And that, by that, I mean never judging other people and always just be willing to listen to them. To be blunt, I think people kind of did a double take when I'd walk into some of these bars, because I would be the only white person in the bar. And there was never a sense of them. They were very welcome. They would go out of their way to welcome me. If anybody was uncomfortable, it was me, and there was no reason to be. And, you know, I'd learned to drop that discomfort a few years ago, because I've been doing this for so long. And it's, if you're comfortable, they're comfortable. So, you know, it's just a very, it's very, I'm very fortunate to do what I do, and for people to invite you to go into other people's worlds and get a small glimpse of it.
Now, of course, your story largely deals with the Great Migration, which I think a lot of Milwaukeeans know about, but we don't necessarily learn about it. Why did most people come here?
Jobs. It was just simply jobs. Everybody had the similar answer. You know, I probably ultimately talked to 50 people, although we only profiled 12. Everybody was very different variations of, look, you know, Milwaukee had factories. The factories were hiring, and, you know, especially the people who came early in the 40s, the factories are also willing to, you know, hire African-Americans, and that wasn't common necessarily across the country. So there became this, you know, kind of pretty straightforward path that if you were, you know, you grew. The common story I heard over and over and over was, you know, my parents had a farm. It was kind of nice. It was small. We had, you know, they would, people would say we weren't poor, but, you know, I guess we were, but I didn't feel poor. But, you know, I wanted a little bit more out of life. I wanted to make a little money. And Milwaukee was a place to go. You know, somebody, you know, they all knew of a relative who had gone, or a friend who had gone. And so, or they moved with their parents. And so there became this pretty common experience of having grown up in a rural part of the South on a farm for most, you know, first 15 years of your life, and then the remaining part of your life being in Milwaukee.
A lot has changed in the city of Milwaukee since the 40s, 50s, and 60s. When you were talking with people, you know, what do they think of the state of the city right now compared to when they first moved here?
You know, everybody, again, was disappointed in the lack of jobs. The jobs why they had moved was easy jobs, and they saw a Milwaukee now where the factories they worked at and the jobs that were available to them weren't there anymore. So there was a lot of nostalgia of, you know, despite the big social changes, there was just that most people missed, you know, the Milwaukee of the 70s and 60s. It's hard to disentangle from them just missing their youth, but, you know, they look at the kids these days and they see less opportunity for them than when they had when they came here.
And, of course, a lot of younger Milwaukeeans are actually moving back to the South, and kind of the opposite of the Great Migration.
Right, and, you know, the other thing that was striking was the amount of people didn't cut their roots with the South. Everybody still has kin back in the South, and then they go once a year to visit pretty regularly. A few cut off because they had bad experiences because of the racism of their youth. But most people continued to go to the South pretty regularly and maintain relationships, and even some maintain land there. They never broke their bonds, which helps explain why Milwaukee, in my mind, again, especially the African-American part of Milwaukee, really feels like a southern city.
You were just talking about the kind of racist experiences they had in the South, but many came to Milwaukee during a very turbulent time for the city, during the Civil Rights era, when there was a significant amount of tension, especially for a northern city. How do they describe living in the city during that time?
I think a lot of them were very disappointed with what they found in Milwaukee when they got there. I was very blunt in asking, you know, when you got to Milwaukee, you know, did you come to escape the racism of the South? And their answer by and large was no. You know, I came for jobs, and what I found here was a place that was equally racist, but it was different. You know, we were in theory allowed to go to different neighborhoods, but not really. You know, many people said I couldn't, you know, I knew where I was allowed to be. Legally, I was allowed to be anywhere, but practically, I wasn't. So there was a lot of, I'd say, you know, bitterness is not a right word because bitterness sounds like it wasn't justified. There was a lot of justified frustration with the state of racial relations in Milwaukee back then and even now. So I tried to keep the peace from being too negative because I had such a positive experience and the people I dealt with were so wonderful and friendly and genuine and just really welcoming and warm. But, you know, it's not a stretch to say that, you know, racial relationships in Milwaukee are not good.
Do you think that kind of warmth in a lot of ways ends up masking the kind of tension that's present?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, there's various forms of people simply saying, look, I can dwell on every error, mistake, and every frustration and be miserable, or I can live my life and make the best of it. And that's not to downplay the frustrations they face, but it's just, you know, people, that's just, you know, people are resilient. And in the face of ugliness, people often rise to the occasion and overcome it. So, you know, I think the lesson I would say, you know, the advice or the lesson I would say, take away from me to anybody who is in Milwaukee and who's white and hasn't been to the north side or hasn't spent significant time is this, you know, go, you know, spend time there. And it's a lot different than the media paints it to be or perception is. It's a wonderful neighborhood that's very welcoming and warm. And there's a lot going on there. And you know, it just takes a little bit of, crossing a threshold that you might not feel comfortable crossing.
Well, Chris Arnotti, thank you so much for coming to Milwaukee to do this story. And thanks for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Arnotti is a writer and photographer whose work can be seen in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. You can learn more about the Great Migrants photo essay at WUWM.com.
Arnotti will be one of the people featured as part of our live event presented in partnership with Milwaukee Magazine Monday night at the Colith TiVo back room.
Erica Slezak came to Wisconsin 50 years ago, but it was not a story of migration. We'll meet an actress who went on to an award-winning career that started right here in Milwaukee. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee Public Radio right after this. We're back with Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The United Performing Arts Fund, UPAF, supports performing arts organizations of various sizes across Milwaukee. The organization began in 1967 as a way to stabilize the finances of groups who would be using the county's new Performing Arts Center.
Well, the arts landscape in Milwaukee was a bit different 50 years ago. It was at that time that a young actress named Erica Slezak was getting her start with a job at the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. Slezak stayed for the better part of 3 years before moving on. She eventually landed the role of Victoria Lord on the ABC soap opera One Life to Live.
Slezak held on to that role for 40 years and won 6 Emmys. But she never forgot the role that Milwaukee had in shaping her career. We reached her at her home outside New York to look back at those formative years for her and the arts in Milwaukee 50 years ago. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes to talk.
Thank you very, very much for asking me to be with you. It was a long time since I've been in Milwaukee, and I'm very delighted to be back there in one form or another.
Well, so let's start there. Do you remember coming to Milwaukee? I mean, these were formative years in your professional career. You'd been kind of born into a theater family, but what did you think moving to a place like Milwaukee following training in a place like London?
Can I tell you honestly that it was the most exciting thing that had ever happened in my life? I left the Royal Academy when I finished in the term, which it was at that time 7 terms, and that was at the end of April, and I came back to this country, and my parents, for some strange, odd reason, had sold our house and had moved back to Europe, and so I stayed with friends, and I couldn't stay in England because I couldn't get a work permit. I stayed with friends here, and my father's agent, who was a wonderful man named Milton Goldman, had said to me when I was a little girl, oh, when you're all grown up, I'll be your agent. So I called him up and I said, hey, I'm all grown up. And he said, oh, great, okay, let me pass you on to another agent. And he passed me on to a very nice agent named John Sakura, who called me one day and he said, listen, the Milwaukee Repertory Theater is looking for a leading lady kind of actress. They want somebody about 29, 30 years old with a lot of experience. And they're willing to pay top dollar, which at that time was, I think, $200 a week. And I said, John, I'm 20 years old, and I have no experience. And he said, well, listen, he just put your hair up, put on a black dress, and go. The first role that they were wanted me to audition for was Electra, Sophocles Electra. Not an easy job.
Right, so no pressure there.
No, none at all. Rada had trained me, Rada being the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, had trained me very, very carefully, had trained all of us in auditioning. You go there, you learn your line, you go, you do the best job you possibly can. You never, ever, ever go and just read it. So I picked out a speech that they had requested. I memorized it, I learned it, and I went there, and it was at the TCG in New York, and Tunç Yalman, who was a Turkish director, he was there, and I introduced myself, and I started the speech, and he said, well, stop. And I thought, uh-oh, what have I done wrong? And he said, did you memorize that? And I said, yes. And he said, oh, okay, wow. Okay, start again and go all the way through. And I went all the way through the speech, and it was a long one. And at the end of it, he said, thank you very much. He said, how old are you? And I thought, do I tell the truth or do I lie? I thought, well, I better tell the truth, because so I said, I'm 20. And he said, and you just graduated from somewhere, from the Royal Academy? I said, yes. And he said, thank you very much. And I left. And about 2 hours later, my agent called me and he said, you got the job. He said, the only thing is they're not going to pay you top dollar because you have this experience. They're going to pay you bottom dollar, which at the time I think was $105 a week or something. And your take-home pay was $83 or $84. And I said, I don't care. I have a job. And the wonderful thing was that Electra was the first production. We then went on to, and there was a wonderful company of actors that they had hired. I wasn't in every single production. I was in probably five of them. The next one, I think, was The Miser, which I was not in. And then they did Design for Living, which was a play Noel Coward had written for himself and the Lunt, Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne. And I was going to play the Lynn Fontanne part. And I thought, okay, no pressure there at all. Because they lived in Genesee Depot, which is not too far outside of Milwaukee.
Right.
And it was Alfred Lunt's family's home. And they attended every production that we did in their honor. And each year we did one. And it was probably so thrilling because, unfortunately, nowadays a lot of actors don't know who they were. But I certainly did. And I thought, God, I've got a job. When do I go? And they said, well, we'd like you there in a week. So I called my sister and I said, can I borrow $200? She said, yes, sure. And I booked myself a flight to Milwaukee. And I had actually called my father first and said, can you tell me where Milwaukee is? And he said, yes, it's in Wisconsin. He said, look it up because you're going to spend some time there. And I was never very good in geography. And I flew there. I booked myself, I think, into the Knickerbocker Hotel. I don't even know if it still exists.
It does.
But it was does it? It was a very nice, kind of nice hotel. And I went to the theater and introduced myself to everybody. And they suggested I go and find an apartment, which I did. And it was a lower level of something. And I was in such rapture about just having a job and being there that I never even bothered to think where I was or what I was going to do or anything like that. I just knew the way from my little apartment to the theater, and that's all I cared about. And during the first year, I got to learn Milwaukee, and it was a lovely, lovely city. I gather it has changed considerably. It's become a big city. But in those days, it was a very manageable, lovely place with beautiful homes in the area, and the downtown area was kind of busy. But I was just so happy to be there, so happy.
Well, and I will say it has grown. I mean, I have only been here for 11 years, but it has grown. But I think anyone who comes here still thinks of it as a manageable city with a lot of lovely homes and really kind of an easy place to get to know.
Yes, that's how I felt. Mind you, my whole focus was on the theater. And so everything that I did was, how do I get from here to the theater? But I just enjoyed it so much. And I bought a secondhand, I think it was about a 10th hand, a Volkswagen. And I had that car for almost 2.5 years. And it was awesome. It was the little old VW with a convertible top. And I would sort of tootle around Milwaukee and go and sort of look at different areas when I had the time off. But mostly I was just so happy to be working and learning lines and meeting the people. And I must say that the board members at the time were so welcoming. And they gave little sort of parties, invitations to us all to get to know each other and them. And it became a real family, which I was very grateful for. My parents came for the opening, and I got a really nice review from Jay Jocelyn, who, and I remember his name because he gave me such a nice review. And my father carried that review in his pocket for about 20 years because it said that I was really good. And it was a family. It was a lovely place to live. And I met lovely, lovely people. I actually got married there at the end of my second year. We were both very, very young. It didn't sort of last longer than a couple of years because we just both had totally different ideas of what we wanted to do and where we wanted to go. But it was a grand time. It was just a grand time in my life.
These are romantic memories with a capital R.
Yeah, they were. I can't think of one bad thing. The worst thing I can think of is that the second year we started the season, I think it was the start of the season, with Othello, and I was playing Desdemona, and they hired a very good actor named, I'm not going to say his name, because he turned out to be not a very nice man. And he was rather annoyed because he obviously didn't read his contract. And in the contract it stated everybody was listed in alphabetical order. And his last name started with a C. The actor playing Iago was Mark Alimo, whose name started with an A. So in the billing, it was listed Mark Alimo, and then blah, 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 and then him. And he was livid. And the last night of the production, he literally had his car running, waiting for him. And after the last curtain call, he left in costume and got in his car and drove away. And which was really not very nice, but he was a very good actor. He was very good. He just had different ideas about what repertory theater was all about. And repertory theater, I think, is so important. And it gave the audience a chance to see a different production every, I'm thinking, 5 or 6 weeks. I think we ran for 5 weeks, and it gave them a chance to see Shakespeare and Sophocles and Ibsen. And Noel Coward. We did so many different productions, Thornton Wilder. You know, where else can you go and every 5 weeks you can see a whole different production with basically a professional company?
Right.
And these were not just people starting out. I was the only one starting out. I was lucky. Everybody else had like years of experience. So it was a wonder, and that's why I think repertory theater is so important as a place for actors to go and work and play all kinds of different roles and gain experience and watch other actors and learn from them. And for the community as well, to have your own theater. It's like, you know, you have your own symphony, you have your own theater. It's wonderful.
Do you have a sense for how that time connected with what you went on to do in the rest of your career?
It was not what I intended to do. I left Milwaukee and I went to the Alley Theater in Houston for a year, which was terrific fun. And I went and spent 5 months with my parents in Europe, and which is where they had moved to. And then I said, I think it's time that maybe I try New York. And I went to New York, and the first job I got was pretty quick. I was hired to play Desdemona in Buffalo. And then I came to New York, and my agent said, would you like to do a soap opera? And I said, I've never seen a soap opera. And I said, do they pay? And he said, yes, they pay very well. I said, then I would like to do a soap opera. And I didn't know anything about the show that I was auditioning for. They just gave me some sides, and they said, go and meet the director, and he'll rehearse with you and another actor. And I said, well, is this the part I'm auditioning for? And they said, no, it's not. It's just a different, it's just a scene. It's not you at all. So, but I asked who the character was, how do you play it? And they told me. And I did the audition, and I got the job. And literally they said, I said, well, what's the character? And they said, that's the character, the part you auditioned for. There was an actress playing the part who I guess was not very happy, and they weren't very happy with her, and they wanted to replace her. And they were going to pay me as much every day as I had been making in repertory theater every week. Now, you didn't work 5 days a week, but still, it was a lot more money. And I thought, at this point, I need to make a little money. So I signed on for 2 years. I had such fun there because it was a little like live theater. We taped it as if live in a half an hour. We're a half an hour show at the time. It was called One Life to Live. and we taped it in exactly a half an hour. So if you had to make a costume change, if you had to change your hairdo, you had to do it in the exact one-minute break for commercials. And we shot it as if live. There was no going back. We didn't stop. I mean, lights fell out of the ceiling, and they didn't stop. They never stopped. So it was very much like live theater. There just was no audience. And then they, you know, it was so much fun. And then I decided to stay a little longer, and then I met my husband. And, you know, we got married, and I thought, this is a really good job if you want a family. Because I got to go home every night. I didn't have to travel. I didn't have to go to, you know, some foreign country to make a movie for 6 months. And I thought, I'm going to just keep this job as long as they will let me. And they let me for a very long time, which was really nice. I had fully intended to go to New York and do theater, which is what I was trained for. And it just didn't quite work out that way. It worked out differently. I did do an off-Broadway play when I'd been on the show for 3 or 4 years, I guess. And that's when I met my husband. And, you know, it all just worked out. That's the only way I can describe it. If I had it to do over again, would I do it the same way? I don't know. But it worked out. And it was a very livable, healthy lifestyle for me. I got up in the morning. I went to work. I came home in the evening. I saw my children. I had their, you know, lots of days off where I could go to, you know, field days and Christmas concerts, as awful as they were. But you know, I had ABC was very good to me. They always gave me those special days off. The only thing I could never be was class mother, but I never wanted to be class mother. So you know, it was a very wonderful, livable life. And I got to stay until 2012 when they canceled us. And believe me, if they hadn't canceled us, I'd still be there because that's how much fun it was. Every day you had a different script. Every day you worked with different people. And wonderful, wonderful actors came through there. You know, some of them for a week, some of them for a day, some of them for a year. But it was an actor's dream for me.
Well, and there is something to be said for letting life take you where life takes you.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's what I was intended. You know, I've always said my most important job in the whole world is being a mother and a wife. That was my most important job. And I got to have it all. I got to be an actress. I got to have be a mother. I got to be a wife. And where else can you do that? You know, Hollywood is a little, you are thrown in, you know, with some very strange people out there.
People have different priorities.
Yeah, completely different. And my husband and I both had the same priority. You know, we loved each other, and we said that comes first, and the kids come first. And then there's other things. And he worked, and I worked. And it all just worked out so well. And I ended up with two fabulous human beings who are my children. And my husband, who's still my husband, which is really nice.
And at the end of the day, you have not been back to Milwaukee.
I have not. No, you know, I often thought about it, but there was never a reason to go. There was never a reason to sort of even take a flight that stopped there, so I could sort of look at it from the air. I have not been back.
Well, I honestly, first of all, it was really delightful to get to chat with you and be able to share your stories of being, you know, working in the theater here 50 years ago. I'm thrilled that we got a chance to talk, and I really do hope that you'll find your way here someday.
I really appreciate that. Thank you. And if there's ever a chance that I will, I will.
All right.
And I appreciate it. Thanks so much for the conversation.
Erika Slezak, thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye, man.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Erika Slezak played Victoria Lord for 4 decades on the soap opera One Life to Live, but before that, she starred for 3 seasons as a member of the Milwaukee Rep Company from 1967 to 1969.
We spoke with her as UPAF, the United Performing Arts Fund, prepares to launch its 50th anniversary annual campaign on Monday. You can find links to more about Erika Slezak and about UPAF at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break and then return with our storytelling series, Ex Fabulo. Lake Effect Weekend returns right after this on 89.7 WUWM.
3, 2, 1.
Welcome to It's Fabulous!
True personal story.
X-Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it is time for X-Fabula Radio. I'm Bruce Winter with X-Fabula co-founder Leah Delaney, who always brings stories with us on a theme, and today's theme is love.
Love. Love is in the air.
How about it?
Well, I'll tell you, the weather last week definitely inspired spring, which brings out all that good, juicy, lovey feelings. And then it snowed. And then everything. I just got divorced. Everybody got divorced.
Everything got covered up, and that was the end of it. So.
But I did bring some stories about love, and we have lots to share because this coming month, and this coming week especially, is going to be packed full of good stuff, good storytelling stuff, and we'll get to those events in a minute. But I say, let's jump right into the stories. What do you think?
Let's do that, because if the theme is love, I want to hear about it.
All right. Well, in par with our theme, the first story was told at one of our February Story Slams back in 2011 when the theme was Valentine, anti-Valentine. Let's listen to Kevin Berry's story.
Would you believe that last night was the first date I ever had on Valentine's Day? Yeah, I know what you're thinking, this awkward ball of awkwardness. You know, how can you go on for so long? I'll tell you, I'll kind of just go through essentially my entire love life over the last 31 years and 5 minutes. So, you know, as a kid, you know, I grew up, you know, I went to school and we would always have Valentine's Day, and, you know, they always really kind of sold into you, you know, how big of a great holiday it was, how it was about love. So, you know, when you get that Valentine that has He-Man and She-Ra together, and it has something that says, you know, by the power of Grayskull, you're sweet. You know, you kind of get into this and you think that's really, you know, it's a really big thing. And so, you know, I always kind of, you know, I liked Valentine's Day as a kid, but as the years went on, you know, as you went out of grade school, the Valentine's became a little bit less mandatory and a little bit more voluntary, and so my Valentine amount kind of dropped off. You know, growing up, you know, I had a few things going against me. One, I was very extremely shy, very introverted. You know, when everybody would be saying, "Hey, let's hop on the party bus, let's have fun," I'd be like, "No, I'm going the other way." Number two, I went to an engineering school, the Milwaukee School of Engineering. And for some of those who there, you probably know the ratio, so it didn't really work out too well. So as it turned out, I had my very first date when I was 26. I was very shy, but eventually I worked my way up. I got the courage to ask a girl out. I was playing volleyball and said, "Hey, can we kind of like hang out?" And she was like, "Yeah, okay, we can do that." So I'm completely jazzed about this. We get together for the first time, and you know, we're having a good time. We're playing some volleyball because that's our thing. And then, you know, later on, we're going to a party, and she says, "Okay, well, why don't you I'll come with you, and we'll drive down to the place." And I hop in, and then I realize, you know, she's sitting in, and she starts to look. Okay, what kind of music do you have? And she sees like CDs, and she says, "All right, okay." And one thing, I was a huge video game nerd growing up, so I loved listening to like video game music and all these other things. So she like looks through the CD. Okay, Final Fantasy Symphonic Suite. Okay. Best of ABBA Gold. Ooh. Stubbs the Zombie. Yeah. Ooh, that sounds pretty cool. It's about zombies. Yeah, it's also a video game. Oh. Okay. So this was, as you can imagine, the most awkward car ride ever. We're just slowly going there, and I'm just saying, "Oh, okay, so do you like to play Nintendo?" yeah, it's okay. Okay. So you say it didn't last too long, but you know, as the years went on, you know, I met other people. You know, got together, but the timing just never worked out. Like every time around Valentine's Day, I would usually, you know, not be in a relationship. Well, that's not true. Like 1 year, I started dating a girl for all of like 1 week. So you know, it's that type of thing where you realize you don't want to, You can't come on strong. So you can't, like, give a card that says, Happy Valentine's Day, I love you. They just see her go, Happy Valentine's Day, I've got pepper spray. So, but, you know, it just seemed as the years would go on, I would not be, you know, with someone or on a date like on Valentine's Day. It almost seemed like some kind of cosmic game that was being played. And one year, the cosmos, like pretty much kicked me in the crotch. I was dating someone, and we were together for a few months. And, you know, we were having a good time, and we were making these plans for, like, a Valentine's Day weekend. We were going to go to have a very fancy dinner, and everything seemed to be okay. And then a few days before, she calls me, and she says, Hey, Kevin, how's it going? I'm doing pretty well. This isn't going to work. I can't be with you. I have to, you know, I think it's best if we just, you know, leave it like this. And you know, part of me is really devastated, and part of me is, like, thinking, really? Really? This is how you're going to do it? It almost felt like, you know, I was on some secret reality show where, like, the producer was like, yeah, we're going to get him. We're going to have her break up with him. And then, like, next episode, we're going to get him together with Jennifer Allison. And she's always looking for love. Oh, it's going to be hilarious. So, but this year, you know, it finally happened after 31 years. Really close to me, you know, we started going out and we had a great time and, you know, we had a great, nothing too big. We just were together and it was very enjoyable. And, you know, and she, you know, I won't say it wasn't awkward like the rest of my preceding 31 years. I will admit there was I somehow shoehorned a conversation of the mating habits of garden gnomes in one of her conversations. But she stuck with it and that is so awesome.
And that was Kevin Berry's story. Oh.
after so many years of I don't want to say failure, but, you know, just being...
Just seeking out that love grail, yeah, you know, the holy grail of love.
And not being able to get there, he finally does. That's a nice ending.
Yes, most definitely. So we got some stuff coming up.
You got a bunch of stuff coming up in March.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so much going on. We have a storytelling workshop for teens coming up on March 4th. We're partnering up with First Stage Theater, and they have a production called Text You Later, which has everything to do with your relationship with your telephonic device. So we're going to have a storytelling workshop at the library where you can learn more about the play itself and then reflect on the role that technology plays in your life. And so Exfabulous storytelling coaches will be there to guide you through small group activities that will help you discover, craft, and share your own true personal stories. You're going to tell your phone stories because I'm sure some teens out there have very tight leashes on their phones.
They're not the only ones. I think people of an older age I have seen, too, that spend too much time on screen.
I'm sorry, what did you say? I was just texting somebody. But if you want more information about that, definitely go to exfabula.org.
Exactly.
And we have another fellowship series coming up, an event on March 7th. The theme is Whiteness and Privilege. And if you're unfamiliar with our fellowship series, we're using real, true personal stories for more activist purposes here. So storytelling as activism. We're going to be tackling some serious issues with whiteness and privilege. And it's going to be a community conversation and storytelling event. So you're going to hear a couple of stories from our fellows. And then we're going to have small breakout sessions where people can sit down with certified facilitators to, you know, discuss some more of your personal stories based on whiteness and privilege. So it's some serious business, but it's a good business. And if you're interested in taking part in that, I would definitely recommend registering right away because those tend to fill up pretty quickly. It's free, but you do need to go to exfabula.org to reserve your slot.
All right. And you can find out all kinds of information at exfabula.org.
I love Exfabula. And our next story, we're jumping back into love. So we are going to travel way back in time to our very first story slam ever held at the Art Bar back in 2009.
First ever? Oh my.
Guess what the theme was? Beginnings. Ah. So let's listen to Beth Lewinsky's story.
When I heard the theme was beginnings, it reminded me of my favorite quote about beginnings, which is actually from Steve Martin, and he writes, "In the beginning of something, its ending is foretold. And we met on an elevator going down." Which, incidentally, is how I met my fiancé, John, is on an elevator going down. I was at a conference for my university out of Indiana, and he was at a conference for his university out of Ohio, and we met in Virginia. I had seen him before the elevator. I had noticed in the opening conference that I was in that was far beyond my pay grade as someone who had worked for the Media Council for approximately 90 days, that he was paying far more attention to me than to the woman who was talking endlessly about PDF format. He took the elevator down with me from the third floor to the first floor, and his opening line to me upon staring at my name tag, which is an uncomfortable situation to be in when your name tag rests here, he said, "Ah, you went to Notre Dame. My mother went there." Also interesting, seeing as he was clearly 35 and Notre Dame had only been co-ed for 29 years. "Really, did she?" He laughed and said, "Yes, but she went to Notre Dame in Ohio, the college, not the university." And I said, "I'd hate to have to pay for the difference on tips." An inauspicious beginning, but he laughed harder than he needed to, and I knew something was up. Not wanting to be a conventioneer, nothing happened with John at that convention. A conversation or two in the lobby, an exchange of conversation in the hallway, always proceeded by my saying, "I'm extremely tired and I have a very early meeting tomorrow," which is hard to get away with when he's on the same schedule as you are. A year or so later, in the course of my duties at my job, my boss asked me to find out about another conference that was taking place in San Francisco. I realized very soon that John, who I had not spoken to since, was the only person I'd ever known who had been to said conference. I IM'd him one day on his IM account and asked him about it. He very quickly, after two or three sentences, asked me if I was still as lovely as I had been in Virginia. It was the beginning of trying to understand how to take a compliment from someone you barely know. Very quickly after that, IM conversations became email conversations, which became phone conversations. And one sweetest day, I took a train from South Bend, Indiana to Cleveland, Ohio. It was the beginning of a much longer journey than the 5 hours it took on a train ride. After a few weeks of dating, very quickly, I love yous were exchanged. Later that year, John bought a house that I was to move into. I saw the house, and he said he was keeping certain rooms for my things, but there wasn't a lot of room for my things. I was very much in love, and it was my beginning of understanding that when the person is in the right place, very little other furniture is needed. However, it was also in some ways the beginning of the end. See, I lied to you when I said my fiancé, John, because John is not even his name. I lied to protect the absent, because one morning when he had arrived at my apartment to take my furniture to begin our cohabitation together, I woke up and he was leaving with only his things. It was the beginning of my understanding that all things are impermanent. But it was also the beginning of a new kind of life. It was the beginning of my moving back here to Milwaukee. It was the beginning of a career in comedy and theater and all sorts of things that would never have happened had he not chose to end our beginning there. And I also couldn't think it was a surprise, because after all, in the beginning of something, its ending is foretold, and we'd met on an elevator going down.
And that was Beth Lubinsky's love story.
Yeah, well, you know, our first story today worked out well. The second one, not so much. But good story nonetheless. And that was from the first story slam ever. That's good.
And we have more story slams coming up. We have a couple more. We have one in March and April, and then we go to the All-Stars. So keep your eyes open for those dates and all of the dates for the fellowship series, the Text You Later event with the teens. Holy cow, so much going on. All of that and much more can be found at xfabula.org.
And if you want to hear these Xfabula radio shows, you can listen at wuwweb.com. Once they are on the air on Saturday and Sunday, then they go up on our website, wuwweb.com. This week's and past week's, you can find them all at wuwweb.com. And we are here every weekend with stories from Xfabula. Leah shows up and brings the stories on a theme, and we'll do it again next week.
Xfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up the show for today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, but do be sure to tune into our weekday version of the show as well at 10 in the morning.
It's all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now for Weekend All Things Considered. Coming up next, it's 4 o'clock.